And as we do every month, Linda Moulton Howe, our investigative roaming reporter, and she's back with a number of great stories for you, and we'll have them all on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Time to pay you a compliment, by the way, Ms. Howe. You ready for it?
Okay.
Here we go. I've gotten more emails over the last 2 months about you and your work. Some people think you should be given a Nobel Prize in science.
Well, thank you very much. It is difficult work because we're in a world where getting to facts and the truth is more difficult than digging up gold anymore, but it is what makes me tick, so I will keep trying.
You keep trying indeed. What do you got in store for us this half hour?
Well, you know, it was a year ago on April 20th of 2010 that the BP Deepwater Horizon oil rig blew up, killing 11 workers on the platform. And nearly a mile below the rig, the Macondo well erupted. And between that day and 4 months later, at the end of July 2010, at least 206 million gallons of crude oil gushed uncontrollably into the Gulf of Mexico, while 770,000 gallons of Corexit were pumped and sprayed into the Gulf to allegedly disperse BP's massive oil slick. The Environmental Protection Agency back then asked BP to stop using the dispersant Corexit 9527 because of short and long-term concerns about its toxicity. And despite the EPA's request, BP continued to spray Corexit 9527 until that ran out, and BP switched to Corexit 9500. Both dispersants can kill incubating sea life. Other concerns include the potential that these dispersants can mutate into new chemical forms, evaporate, and fall back to Earth as rain. And on Coast and at my news website, earthfiles.com, over the past year, I've interviewed half a dozen people who have been going out into the Gulf on scientific research and finding that there is dead life south and north of the Macondo oil site.
That's not good.
No, it is not. And what I'm going to be talking about tonight on Coast, and everyone listening can go to earthfiles.com, and on my headlines page, there are hot links to each of my reports, and you will be amazed to look at the fish. I have a whole lot of images that have been caught just in the last 4 to 6 weeks in an area that stretches from the mouth of the Mississippi going east toward Panama City, Florida. It's that area that we're talking about, and there are at least two scientists who have been trying to study what started with the fishermen, George, who began saying there's something wrong with the fish that we're catching, and one, they all want to remain anonymous because they were afraid of some sort of retribution by the BP forces and the political forces, but at least the professors are going on the record. And what the public has not known until right now, for the very first time this week, NOAA finally confirmed, not in a press release, but in an email to a Gulf committee, that they are acknowledging that there are sick fish in the Gulf, but that if you cook them, then you are killing the bacteria and whatever's wrong with them. But there is a scientist, Professor James Cowan, in the Louisiana State University Department of Oceanography and Coastal Sciences. And he has been getting fish from one of the fishermen and getting them to labs under LSU. No outside commercial money. This is all within the university. He insisted that he had to remain independent for this work. And he has emailed me images of these sick fish that I have at earthfiles.com. And they are ranging from red snapper, vermilion snapper, golden tilefish, to the gray fish. And what they have found and what I'm going to go into is so you can hear from a fisherman himself who has been getting the samples to Professor Cowan and to another scientist we're going to hear from. So far, they know from lab tests that there are two kinds of bacteria that they are finding in this fish. One is Vibrio vulnificus, and the other is Photobacterium damselae, and that these are both contagious within the fish. So there's a worry about decimation of already weakened fish populations. But Vibrio is what makes people sick when they eat raw seafood. So they are now saying to everyone, fishermen and everyone, cook this food, and if you see anything on any of these fish in the Gulf and you have any cuts or sores, do not handle. So now, with that as some background, and knowing that we're talking about this area where so much oil came in and is still coming in today, George, that's what I'm learning.
Right.
There are tar balls, there are thick tar underneath the sand in this area where also where they're going out to catch the fish. Does it prove that Corexit and the crude oil are responsible for all these sick fish and all the dead sea life down on the seafloor? Proof in a court of law? No. But are they continuing to work on this with the idea, as Professor Cowan told me, that he thinks there is definitely a geographic link between where they're finding the fish and where the worst oil came in? And also, independently studying all this is Professor William Frank Patterson in biology at the University of West Florida in Milton, Florida. And Professor Patterson told me that he has 1 to 2% of the fish being given to him that have these lesions and bulbous and discoloration and are sick, whereas Professor Cowan on a recent Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama cruise found as many as 10 to 12% of the fish there showed the disease symptoms. Both scientists wonder if the bacteria will spread more rapidly now as temperatures in the Gulf warm this summer. And now we're going to begin with Professor Patterson, followed by a fisherman off the Louisiana coast who has been getting samples to Professor Cowan.
In winter 2010-2011, we started to get reports from some fishermen that fish were being captured offshore, which had some skin issues, lesions, fin rot, and some discoloration. Later on, late winter, early spring, we started to see fish on our video samples that also had issues with fin rot and some pigmentation pattern issues. Fishermen have continued to catch fish that have some of these symptoms, and there have also been other species now captured besides red snapper, such as tomtate, vermilion snapper, tilefish. In a recent cruise off the coast of Mississippi, Louisiana, and Alabama, I've heard reported as many as 10% of the fish had some issues.
Wow.
So we're not really sure at this point how prevalent these symptoms are. We don't know ultimately what the cause of the symptoms might be, but we are quite concerned about their occurrence. Fishermen that have been helping us, they're really in a bind, because if, in fact, the symptoms that we're seeing are somehow related to Deepwater Horizon and petroleum that was on the shelf in the water column, that needs to be documented to look at the long-term chronic effects. If there are serious effects, then to monitor any recovery that may occur. And so the livelihood of many, many folks is derived from the water. They're on the water much more than scientists are. But this sort of conundrum they're in, because if things are reported widely now, then that can really hurt the markets. And so it's a tough situation for many of the fishermen to be in. And we're thankful as scientists that many fishermen have stepped forward and have really helped the effort to try to document some of these issues.
One fisherman who has worked Louisiana Gulf waters for 25 years is so alarmed by the black discolorations on fish he's been catching that he contacted Professor James Cowan at Louisiana State University in Baton Rouge. Professor Cowan is working with Professor Patterson to try to find out what is killing the Gulf fish. For the past month, The Louisiana fisherman has been delivering dead fish samples to Professor Cowan. The fisherman has asked for anonymity because he thinks BP Oil is buying cover-ups and attacking critics in the deteriorating Gulf condition that is unlike anything he has ever seen in a quarter century of Gulf fishing, crabbing, and shrimping.
We're seeing areas that we used to be able to catch fish in, and they're just gone. And now we're starting to see legions on the fish, and we've never seen them before. These are black. And just this year is the first time we ever seen anything that was black on the fish like that. We used to fish an area called Sackett Bank. It's around the mouth of the Mississippi Canyon. And we used to catch vermilion snappers there and various groupers. Now, once you get on the west side of the Mississippi River, about 30 miles continuing east, there just aren't any fish there anymore. Whether they died, left, or both, we're just not sure.
And where are you having to go now to fish?
Well, basically, we're fishing further and further to the west, fishing more off towards Texas.
When did you start seeing the tilefish with the black marks that are the infections on them?
Well, that just began in the last month.
What was the first thing that you saw that made you say something's wrong here?
Well, the first thing that I saw that I thought was really, really wrong wasn't even involving fishing. It was just running along at night, and I had all my lights on the boat, big floodlights, and I was running along, and nothing showed up on my radar, and all of a sudden I saw a big white wall in front of me, and I pulled my boat out of gear, and I slid through a great big foam line. It was about 6 foot high out of the water and about 7 or 8 foot wide, and I had never seen anything like that in my entire life.
What caused it?
My guess would be the dispersants and detergent-type action made a big foam line, almost like the little sea foam that you see at the beach, only huge.
Where was that?
Oh, that was about 50 miles offshore and about, close to 100 miles from the site.
From the BP Oil site?
Right.
100 miles which direction?
West-northwest.
What date approximately would you have seen that big wall of foam?
Oh, I'd say that was late August of last year. 2010.
No fish were there, and it took until November for you to see fish there again?
Right.
What made you contact Professor Cowan?
Well, the fact that I'd seen these legions on other fish that friends of mine had caught on the east side of the river, I had realized immediately what it was because I had seen it on other fish that other friends of mine had caught. I know Dr. Cowan's had thousands a day of sea experience, and he's, just like us, has never seen these black legions on fish before. I've fished out of Louisiana for 25 years, since 1985, and I've never seen what I'm seeing this year, ever.
Could you tell me also about the crabber?
Well, in our area, you know, we have a lot of shrimpers and crabbers, and I heard that it had been going downhill, and I asked my friend, how's the crabbing? And he pulled 170 traps and had 9 blue crab in them, and normally he's catching 700 or 800 pounds, and he had a total of 9 crabs.
It means that the crabs are gone.
Yes, they're gone. They've been gone for a month or so.
Are all the crabbers experiencing this complete absence of crabs?
Yeah, and the shrimpers, because when they drag their nets, they catch crabs with them too. And I'm beginning to get worried about what's happening to our Gulf. I'm asking everybody what they're seeing, and nobody's seeing any crabs.
Has this ever happened before?
No, never.
And what is the situation with shrimp?
Well, it seems to be pretty slow. It doesn't seem like they're doing that great this year. And the biggest concern that people are saying right now is that BP is going to blame it on the fresh water from the river, but the water hasn't gotten here yet.
Well, we know that the Mississippi River was not flooding a month ago when you started seeing the tilefish coming up from deep water with black lesions on them.
Oh, all the fish experiencing that problem were way ahead of the river. But our concerns are a couple years down the road when we're concerned about the juvenile fish and the reproductive process of the fish, plus possibly losing a good percentage of our fish.
So what you mean is, if they are dying out now, the adult fish that you've been seeing with all the lesions and the fin rot and all of that, which is being reported now by scientists, that you could end up with no juveniles in another couple of years because the whole population of all of the fisheries could be going down.
That's correct. We feel that we've already lost a lot of juveniles from last year and possibly the really young fish from the year before. We're just not sure if it's contagious from fish to fish. And if it's contagious from fish to fish, then we stand to lose a whole fishery, much like the herring fishery in Alaska.
After the Exxon Valdez.
Correct. They lost their entire fishery, and basically they started with the same problems, having lesions on the fish.
There was one fisherman who said to me, I look at BP and the government as making a decision to save real estate instead of the fisheries in the Gulf of Mexico.
What I would say is right now, our government has a blind eye to it. They are not even looking. There's a lot of money being spent to promote safe seafood and stuff like that in the Gulf, but there's no money being spent to address the problems that we're seeing in the Gulf.
So there's kind of a whitewash for the tourist business while the Gulf itself is sick.
Oh, I think that would be an understatement at this point, knowing what I know. I'm scared to death because I'm starting to realize that we really do have some serious problems in the Gulf of Mexico.
Why do you think that the politicians are not putting this as a priority to help right now?
They want this problem to go away because there's so many other problems out there that we're just a minor problem in the mix of everything.
But if the fishery business in the Gulf has nothing to fish, then it means that there will be thousands of people over the next 2 to 3 years in the Gulf of Mexico who are without jobs.
Oh, yeah. I know people today that are without jobs. The crabber that I talked about, he no longer has a job. He cannot catch enough to make a living. And that's what I'm concerned about in my future.
What is your personal perspective on what is going to be the future of the Gulf in the next 5 to 10 years?
I think we're going to have a lot of problems, quite a few fisheries, especially the ones that are based in the central Gulf of Mexico. We're going to see some real problems. There's not going to be a lot of fish to catch in 5 years, and that's my biggest fear. Knowing what I know now and knowing about the infection in the fish, I have to say that it's looking darker and darker for us. I'm worried about being able to make a living 3 years from now.
And George, I'm going to do another report with Professor James Cowan, who is trying to get a handle on what is the state of the juvenile population. He confirmed that they really aren't seeing the crabs. He confirmed that there's low shrimp counts, and this goes up and down in the oceans. Is it possible that they will have a spike in the population another year or two, or will this summer with these bacteria that can go from fish to fish? This fisherman did not know the confirmation on this bacteria when I interviewed him. We now know that the fish have two very contagious bacteria. So the next step is, what is going to be happening to the young in the Gulf?
What an awful, awful situation. Thank you, Linda. And she'll be back with more stories of high strangeness on Coast to Coast AM. Just how bad is that disaster in Japan, and how could that radiation affect us here on the western coast of the United States and elsewhere? Up next, more with Linda Moulton Howe on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. We've got Linda Moulton Howe. Linda, you know, we continue to get stories out of Japan that things are worse than they say.
That's right. It's like I'm going from the Gulf, where things are worse than we're hearing in the United States, over across the other side of the world to Japan, where it is very clear since March 11th that authorities there, I'm just going to use the word, they have whitewashed, they have been trying to play down what now is appearing by many, many authorities to be worse than Chernobyl. Today, Greenpeace reported that one of its research crews earlier in May 2011 tested water and marine life outside Japan's 12-mile territorial limit beyond Fukushima. Greenpeace radiation expert Jan van de Put said in a press release, quote, "Despite what the authorities are claiming, radioactive hazards are not decreasing through dilution or dispersion of materials, but the radioactivity is instead accumulating in marine life," close quote. Fish and shellfish samples collected and tested in French and Belgium laboratories all showed, quote, "significant levels of radioactive contamination," close quote, "and sampled seaweed is 50 times higher than what is considered safe." Further, Ken Busler, a chemical oceanographer at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution on the East Coast, said that new research of waters up to 19 miles offshore from Fukushima show radioisotope levels that are 10 times higher than radioisotopes measured in the Baltic and Black Seas during Chernobyl. He said, quote, "When it comes to the oceans, the impact of Fukushima exceeds Chernobyl." The Greenpeace and Woods Hole research imply that radioactive water is still leaking from the Fukushima nuclear power plant complex that was so damaged in the March 11th earthquake and following tsunami. In fact, recently TEPCO, that owns and manages the Fukushima plant, said their data indicates cracks and holes as big as 10 centimeters, George, that's almost 4 inches,
I know, it's,
in the nuclear reactor containment vessels, especially in Unit 1 and Unit 3 that exploded on March 12th and 14th, respectively. Reactors 1 and 3, and these were the quotes, suffered nuclear fuel meltdowns. TEPCO now admits this, and some nuclear engineers think that the units 1, 2, 3, and 4, all of them suffered some form of partial meltdowns. Unit 3 has MOX fuel that contains more plutonium than the nuclear fuel rods in the other reactors. Now, TEPCO also has reported that in Unit 3, the pipes necessary to carry emergency cooling were probably damaged early on, and that's why the water level inside Unit 3 fell so low. TEPCO says much of Unit 3's nuclear fuel likely melted down and collected at the bottom of the pressure vessel over the next 24 hours around the time of the March 14th explosion. And that would explain why there were powerful explosions. Could have been one and then followed by two explosions, mm-hmm. You're going to hear in a minute. Now, one man who has been keeping track of the Fukushima nuclear disaster on a daily basis is Scott D. Portzline, security consultant for Three Mile Island Alert in Harrisburg. And he was born in 1958, was 20 years old when TMI, the Three Mile Island Unit 2 reactor, began to melt down back then. And then by 1984, he wanted to know the truth about what had caused that near meltdown. And a decade later, Scott had lost confidence in government explanations and began to question how much radiation had escaped from the TMI reactor. What had radioactive contamination done to the people, plants, animals, and insects around that Harrisburg Three Mile Island area? And why did the government and nuclear industry tell the public that only small quantities of radiation had been released with exposures far below levels that could affect health, when that was not true? And he felt like with Fukushima that all those old questions, the whole situation of governments and authorities trying to cover up a potentially disastrous situation was replaying again in the spring of 2011. He has watched the Japanese government authorities try to downplay and whitewash a nuclear disaster that potentially can still affect the whole northern hemisphere if that plutonium-bearing might have been 500 pounds of plutonium-bearing MOX fuel in there. If Unit 3 yet gets out of control and goes into what is called a prompt criticality that could explode even more plutonium into the atmosphere, while right now, as we are doing this report tonight, there are many people who think Unit 3 exploded the spent fuel rods containing more plutonium than the other units out in those explosions beginning on March 14th. And now we're going to hear from Scott Portzline, who feels like it's all happening again, only this time it is worse.
Most people think things have gotten much better at Fukushima and have no idea that they're no better. Nothing is better. They've made a few plugs here and there, but it's still leaking. It's still fissioning at Unit 3, that the radiation levels are higher than they thought, that the water levels in the reactor are lower than they thought. Once they got the gauge to work properly, they found out they didn't have any water in the reactor at Unit 1. This just happened the other day. Since May 5th, we saw at Unit 3 the temperature rise by 100 degrees Celsius and then another 100 degrees Celsius. So that indicates to me that there's something fissioning at Unit 3. In fact, TEPCO said they started adding boron to that reactor. Their reason was that since they switched over to fresh water instead of seawater, that they'd have to add boron to prevent recriticality. But I believe that's just Japanese nuclear speak for we are going to tell you 3 weeks from now that there may have been recriticality, and then another 3 weeks later we'll confirm that there was recriticality.
And what is your perspective right now on the story that there may have been ejected plutonium-bearing MOX fuel out of Unit 3?
Yes, and that's a strong probability, because I don't know if you saw the latest video underwater camera of the spent fuel pool Unit 3, and it is obliterated. There's large pieces of iron and I-beams and racks are distorted. I think most of it was ejected upwards in what some people believe was a prompt criticality, which would have been very similar to the prompt criticality that occurred at Chernobyl. And what you have happen is the fuel gets rearranged geometrically into a configuration where fission criticality can occur very rapidly. In this case, a moderated prompt criticality because of the water acting as a moderator. And then you have an explosion of steam and gases with such power that it ejected these spent fuel fragments and pieces hundreds of feet into the air and up to a mile away.
Is there any speculation about how much plutonium might have been ejected from Unit 3 and how much is out in the atmosphere in the water?
I don't know of any projections of that, but we've got to be talking about several hundred pounds at least. And this is a very grave situation because some of that will circle the globe. Most of it will fall out because it's heavy into the sea or into the local area or into the crops and the livestock, which the Japanese people in the area have been advised to abandon their livestock now.
And it might be related to this Unit 3 issue because it only takes tiny particles of plutonium breathed into lungs to cause cancer and death eventually. And I'm wondering if it could also relate to the mid-May order from the Japanese government to expand even further the zone of clearing people and animals out around the Fukushima plant.
Well, that's probably a contributing factor. The report in the news from Japan was because of atmospheric conditions. Well, that means a storm in my lexicon, but now in their lexicon, that's got to mean radiation. And, of course, with plutonium being virtually a death sentence, I guarantee if you inhale it into your lungs, like you said, just takes one particle to lodge in your lung and emit radiation, you're guaranteed to die from that eventually. So, yeah, that's probably one of the factors. Originally, this is an interesting subject because when this accident first began, reporter's number one question was, what's the worst case scenario? And most people were saying a core meltdown. And I was one of the people saying the worst case is actually a spent fuel pool accident where fire would volatilize many radioactive isotopes, cesium, iodine, strontium, plutonium, americium, and deposit it into the air, and then that can last for weeks. So that's what I thought would be the gravest concern. And you asked me about an explosion. Is there any way we could have ejection from these spent fuel pools? And my answer was, I can't think of any factor that would cause that. And so...
now we know it happened.
Yeah, I was wrong. In fact, what we think may have occurred was actually two explosions. What I found out was there's a sound file connected with the explosion of the Unit 3 building. We can't draw absolute conclusions from it because the sound was manipulated. It was realigned in time because you have to allow 5 seconds in delay for each mile distance between the explosion and where the video was filmed and recorded. I do think that the sound file shows that there was two explosions, which would have been very similar to Chernobyl, where just a few tenths of a second apart, two different types of explosions occurred, and one would have been the prompt criticality, the other is the steam explosion. It's possible, then, that there was a hydrogen explosion at Unit 3. It rearranged the fuel in the spent fuel pool into a geometric configuration that caused a prompt criticality, which would have created much more energy than a hydrogen explosion, allowing these fuel rods to be ejected hundreds of feet into the air and even a mile away from the plant.
Do they have anyone that's independent that is there measuring the radioactivity now?
I'm not aware of any independent radiations. I know that they asked for the French to help gain control of the reactors and come up with plans, which at every turn has just fallen apart. Responders went in to Unit 1 the other day to see how they could create some cooling, and they had to leave because the radiation was at deadly levels. Within 4 hours, it would have caused death.
And the third worker has now died recently in middle May, even though TEPCO is saying that they don't know why exactly the worker died. It seems that there's a lot of radioactivity and stress and heat, and they've lost 3 workers. They have now got this temperature increase that you're describing. What do you think could be the worst case if this has been a prompt criticality in Unit 3, and that along with an increase in temperature may be tied with more radioactivity related to that plutonium?
There's definitely a chance of that, and I'm pretty sure recriticality has occurred with a smaller portion of that fuel. But it just goes to show how out of control this is, how long it can continue. In fact, this is so bad that we're really needing to go to a different level on the nuclear event scale. There should be a level 8 created by the International Atomic Energy Agency. In fact, some of the nuclear engineers that I work with are in the next week or so going to urge the International Atomic Energy Agency to create a level 8 to more accurately reflect what's happening at Fukushima.
And what would 8 be compared to 7?
Well, the two biggest factors would be we have multiple source terms from multiple sources. We have 3 reactors with core melt accidents and meltdown through the vessels, probably in all 3 of them. And we have spent fuel pool accidents in 4 units that we know of.
Mm-hmm.
It also calls for another distinction, and that's the need for international assistance. When you have this many units, which no one ever dreamed of, no one ever dreamed that they would need so many responders and so much equipment. So the only way to combat this would be for international cooperation, not only with radiation measurements and the water and the food, but flying in special equipment to pump concrete or pump water, which has already been done. There's a huge barge tank, a float they're calling it, about to be put in place at Fukushima that was retrofitted to hold 10,000 tons of water. This should have been done a long time ago, but it takes time because we're not prepared. And so if there were a level 8 event, it would better clarify the severity and the responsibilities that come up with this. We're seeing response delays, confusing plume projections, cross-contamination. where workers aren't sure where the radiation is coming from, so it's hard to develop plans of where to go throughout the plant to try to investigate what's going on. You have prolonged control issues, periodic or sustained radioactive releases lasting for weeks, or in this case, it's going to be months.
What you're saying is Fukushima already is worse than Chernobyl in terms of complexity, sources, and the length of time that it's now projected to go on for months.
Yes, it is a whole new level, and that needs to be recognized. In Japan, there's already talk that it's going to be $50 billion to $100 billion, and I laughed at that because just the reactors that they've lost were worth $38 billion.
Wow.
And when you factor in all the responses and all the effects it's had on people's life, it's easily going to be $1 trillion. And I don't know how Japan's going to recover from this. They've already been in desperate straits. And this is one reason they've decided we can't afford to pay that price again. We are going to not pursue nuclear power anymore. We're going to pursue renewables.
Unit 1, 2, 3, and 4. Until they are truly shut down, we're not out of the woods on this Fukushima threat to the world.
That's right. Cold shutdown, then we have to stop all the leakage that is occurring, whether it's through water, air, or direct shine. In this case, we saw incidents of direct shine where neutron beams were being created. This is unlike any accident we've ever seen. This will go beyond the end of this year for at least two of them.
And that is a reality check, George, on what is happening in Japan, even if the CBS, NBC, and ABC, you know, they have not been covering this. I don't know why, really.
No, they're not.
And
it's amazing.
Almost makes me wonder about political pressure from a government agency to some of the media to downplay because this administration wants nuclear power to expand in the United States, so they may want to divert media and public attention from how serious this is. But on May 24th, the New York Times had a headline, "Risk from spent nuclear reactor fuel is greater in the United States than in Japan, study says." This is remarkable. It's from the Institute for Policy Studies. And here's a fact. 75% of American spent nuclear fuel is stored in pools just like Fukushima.
Jeez.
And when you absorb that, and then you go to one plant in the United States, which is almost like a twin of the Fukushima units. It's the Vermont Yankee on the border of Massachusetts and Vermont. The spent fuel in that pool at the solitary reactor exceeds the inventory, the amount of the spent fuel to all four of the damaged Fukushima reactors combined.
Jeez.
That one on the east coast of the United States is sitting there with an inventory four times in its singular vulnerable spent fuel. And what they're saying is that because President Obama canceled a plan for a repository at Yucca Mountain in the Nevada desert for spent fuel, that then puts an emphasis on the fact that our nation's reactors are where spent fuel is going to be for the foreseeable future. And that comes down to what the Institute for Policy Studies is recommending, that the United States transfer most of the nation's spent nuclear fuel from pools filled with cooling water to what they call dry sealed steel casks. And this is trying to limit in the United States what could happen here to match Fukushima.
Up next with Linda, what's happening to hundreds of leopard sharks? And later on, we're going to check in with her about a human abduction case. You won't believe that one. We'll be back on Coast to Coast AM.